Iowa's prisons are designed to punish and rehabilitate people who have committed serious crimes, but they are also meant to serve the victims of those crimes. Today, we continue our series on corrections in Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we focus on victims. Linda Sorensen's daughter Leah was murdered when she was 17 years old. Now Linda is a victim services coordinator. Larry Wohlgemuth lost his childhood to sexual and physical abuse. Now he speaks to sexual offenders in prison. And Mary Roach is the director of Iowa's Victim and Restorative Justice Programs. I'll talk with them. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we continue our series on corrections in Iowa with a focus on victims. Committing a murder can land an offender in prison for the rest of his or her life. That same crime sentences the people who loved the victim to a lifetime of hurt and sorrow. This hour, I'll talk with Larry Wohlgemuth, who was the victim of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse as a child. He now speaks with sexual offenders in prison. Mary Roach will be here. She is the director of Iowa's Victim and Restorative Justice Programs. My first guest today is Linda Sorensen. She is the Victim Service Coordinator for the 6th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections. Her daughter, Leah, was murdered in 1989. Linda, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go back to 1989. Your daughter, Leah, was 17 years old.
Right.
And you helped her get ready for prom.
Yes.
You sent her off and she didn't come home that night. When did you start to get worried?
You know, I always gave Leah a curfew. That was the one night I really felt safe because I knew she'd be with all her friends from high school and she was getting ready to graduate. And I remember the last thing she said to me as she was after prom when she came home and changed into her jeans and favorite sweatshirt and stuff. And she says, "Thanks, Mom. I love you, Mom." And I knew the thanks was that, you know, I trust her enough to be out without having a curfew. And it wasn't until really the next day when she didn't show up getting close to noon that I started looking for her.
Right. What did you do? What did you do when you started to worry?
Well, I called her friend's house first, but her friend kept kind of avoiding me, didn't want to have to talk to me. And it took a while. Finally, she said that, well, Leah didn't go home with her, that she met an acquaintance after their prom parties and stuff, and that she gave a first name of Jeff. She didn't know his last name or much about him, except that he promised to give Leah a ride home.
Did you call the police?
I did, but at the time, they just kind of chalked it up to, you know, the kids are, you know, prom night, out all night, graduation and stuff. And I says, yeah, but Leah knew me, and she knew that she'd better at least call home. And her not being with somebody like her friend really had me concerned.
As time went on, I'm sure that concern grew. How did you find out what happened to her?
It took a long time.
How long did it take?
Oh, let's see, prom was Saturday. It was probably, it was Monday evening before we found her. We went through 3 different shifts of officers Sunday till like about 2 a.m. in the morning when an uncle of his finally took us over to where Jeff lived.
So you actually went to his apartment?
Yeah, we didn't go in. It turned out that nobody was at home in any of the apartments, so we were told to go. My husband and I were told to go back home. And the next day, she became newsworthy where they did a missing persons report. But I was back and forth to that house different times and finally asked a neighbor to call me if anybody showed up. And she did later on in the, towards evening, Monday evening, and said two young men and two young women went into the house. And so my husband and I just hopped in the car and ran down there, flew, I suppose, and already in that shock mode. And I just felt like I was, gosh, it was like I was living in another dimension of some kind, because it just, everything just went so fast from there. And I remember going into the house and knocking at the door in the second floor apartment, and I could hear the voices, and it wasn't Leah. And they didn't know her, but they remembered us from seeing us on the news. And they said, well, no, Jeff lived upstairs, and there was a door right across from where theirs was. And my husband grabbed the doorknob, and one of the young men grabbed a butter knife, and they jammed the lock, and the door popped open. And we went upstairs, and nobody was up there, of course, but you start looking around. And while my husband and a young woman was in the living room, I was in the kitchen, and I saw a little cubbyhole area where there was like a fold-out bed or cot and a little nightstand next to it. There was no sheets, nothing on the bed, blankets or anything. And it was starting to get dark, so I started looking for a light switch coming around to the living room, and my husband and this young woman went to a closet that where a door was partly open, and they lifted a pile of blankets and saw a leg. And that's when they yelled, get her downstairs. And there was a police helicopter flying over the house during this time. I guess they were on their way with a search warrant, just that we beat them. And they got me downstairs and had somebody lock the door so I couldn't go back in. And at that moment, my daughter actually became the property of the state. I never got to see her because there was a heating vent underneath underneath that closet floor, and so everything was accelerated with her body.
Oh.
And I remember coming out of the house screaming, not my daughter, not my baby, this can't be happening to me. I thought God at the time was punishing me for something in my past, and was put on the neighbor's step and told to bury them to a paper sack, and then taken down to the police department because we broke into the apartment. They didn't charge or anything, but I never got to see my daughter, not even after that, because the funeral director decided I couldn't handle seeing her. He said, just imagine she gained 50 pounds.
After your daughter was found, how long did it take to find the young man who murdered her? He was 19 years old, mm-hmm. Jeffrey Haas.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take for the police to find him?
They found him in South Dakota. He was, I think he maybe had family out that way, and we think that's where he was headed. And they did stop him, and thank God there was a DCI agent around there, and they did question him, and he knew he was going to get caught, he said, and he did confess. There was a tape confession. And the funny thing is he took her jeans and her purse and her shoes that she was wearing, and they were in the trunk of his car. And I always thought they were like his trophies, because earlier, you know, he said that he couldn't believe what he had done. So that was a reminder to him that he did, but it was just kind of weird.
And he raped her, yeah, and he strangled her to death.
Yes, first with a necktie and then with his hands. He said she didn't say anything. She pushed him, and he lost it.
After the trial, after he was sent to prison,
mm-hmm.
what kind of support was there for you and for your family? You had three younger kids. Mm-hmm. Leah was the oldest of four.
Mm-hmm.
Who could you turn to?
And back in 1989, although there were a few victim services, there weren't very many. There wasn't anything for homicide survivors around here. And I just remember, you know, being up in the middle of the night and wondering, how do you go to bed? How do you sleep and get up the next day and continue the rest of your life? Because at the time, I just wanted them to bury me with my daughter. And I did reach out to the county attorney's office. They just had hired a victim witness coordinator. And I wanted to start a support group. I didn't feel it was fair for anybody to have to go through what I was. And I just wanted to reach out to others. And she helped. We ended up applying for a grant through the county attorney's office. So with the help of her and then St. Luke's Hospital, a grief counselor, and Family Service Agencies, which is Horizons now, they were able to get this grant, and I started working as a volunteer, just starting support groups, and also at the same time for Compassionate Friends. So I was going back and forth doing support groups, and there was just so many people that would come. There was one lady in particular I remember that called me, and she had lost her sister like 30 years prior, and she said, "I thought I was going crazy." I says, "No, you're not." And there's just so many hurting people out there that there's never any closure. I hate that word because I don't care how long it takes. You learn to adapt. I think that's a better word. And you move on and you work at healing, which I did. I prayed for a miracle, but I wanted my miracle to be, I turn on my porch light, my daughter shows up. But my miracle came in that I believe the Lord opened doors for me. And after trying to work a part-time job and volunteering with the support groups, I was offered a full-time position going to court with homicide survivors and stuff. So I could do it, but I felt guilty getting paid for it at first. But I hope, and I've been told that I've been able to help a lot of people, but I says, you know, they've all reached right back to me. That's when my healing really started.
10 years after your daughter was killed, mm-hmm. you met with her murderer face to face. What made you want to do that?
I still had questions. I didn't get to sit in during the trial. We were sequestered to sit outside the courtroom because we were witnesses. So we had to rely on people coming out and telling us things. And I still wanted to know why. I could not wrap my brain around a 19-year-old young man doing something so horrible. What drove him to get to where he was at? It was a heartache. You know, there's never any winners in those things anyway, but I wanted to know why. Why did he pick my daughter? What was he going to get from that? I mean, I just don't get the snapping, and I've been told by other inmates since that time, you don't just snap. But I always thought that I could just go. It should be my right to go in and say, you know, I have a right to these answers. But I found out it's not that way, that there's a whole process. And it was victim-offender dialogue. And I heard another mom talk about meeting her offender, and she told me who to contact, so I did. And she told me I needed to go back, get some therapy with my grief person, who I don't know what I would have done without him. He is now a head chaplain at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids.
We have to take a short break, okay. And we'll get back. I want to talk to you about what that meeting was like, what you gained from that experience in just a moment. My guest is Linda Sorensen. She is the Victim Service Coordinator for the 6th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections. She also lost her daughter, Leah, to murder in 1989. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're focusing on victims. We're continuing our series on the correction system in Iowa, and we'll continue talking with people who are involved in victim advocacy and victim support. In just a moment, Larry Wolgemuth will be speaking with us. He was a victim himself of sexual and physical abuse. He now speaks with sexual offenders in prison. Mary Roach will also be here. She's director of Iowa's Victim and Restorative Justice Programs. And Carl Schilling, president of the Iowa Organization for Crime Assistance, will join us as well. With me right now is Linda Sorensen, and she lost her daughter, Leah, in 1989. Leah was murdered by a young man just 2 years older than she was. She was raped and murdered the night of her prom. And Linda, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that 10 years after Leah was murdered, you did come face to face with the man who killed her, Jeffrey Hass.
Yes.
And after you went through the process to get ready to face him, tell me about that meeting. What was that like?
I don't think anybody can really prepare until you actually are there, you know, with all the prep we did ahead of time. You never know what you're going to feel or anything when you walk in the door. But when he came in, I always kind of pictured this monster. And when he came in, the mask of the monster came off, and I had to see him as a human being. And that was different, you know, hard, because it was easier to hang on to the hate and stuff. But he came in, and he sat down, and I was able to tell him about who Leah really was. It was important for me to know he hadn't forgotten what had happened. And I could tell he kept his head down a lot, and I told him, I says, I need you to look at me. And he said, I don't feel I have the right to. And I thought, wow, he felt something. I needed to know that he felt something. And I asked him what he saw. I know that he had put her in the closet, and then he took her out after he came back from work, and he said he couldn't stand looking at it, and he put her back. I wanted to know what he saw. And I could see in his face, he said she looked really, really bad. And I had taken pictures along that I saw much later on after those 10 years of my daughter, and they were in an envelope, and I thought if he forgot, maybe I would take them out, but it turned out that I didn't have to. But it was important for me to know that he did not forget. He did not take, he took full responsibility. He did not try to blame it on anything about drinking or drugs or anything, and he said it wasn't her fault, and he told me it wasn't my fault. That meant a great deal that he owned it.
How do you think coming face to face with him changed you? You'd been living with this grief, this anger, this sorrow for 10 years.
Yeah.
How did that meeting change things for you?
I really feel that I was able to let go of whatever I was holding on to inside. It was so deep and so painful, but it was like I was able to just unload that and give it to him, and he was willing to take it. Some people think of it as some kind of a forgiveness. Maybe it is. It depends what forgiveness means to you. Because sometimes I think I have, and then sometimes I take it back. But it was a letting go. And I felt my daughter's presence during that whole thing. I just know she was there. And I asked him, I says, have you ever asked Leah for forgiveness? And he says, I can't do that. And I said, yes, you can. And in some sense, I think maybe I have, and nobody really can understand that unless you're there. It's, you know, there's so many things, and I keep thinking one day maybe Mary will let me go back so I can tell him to his face that I'm going to be okay. And I really hope that he's okay, too. I think that it's helped him a great deal as well.
Before we move on, tell me something about Leah.
Oh, Leah, she was my sunshine. You know, at 17, you just have all the answers, and you can just, she was ready to take on the world. She was looking forward to graduating, and she was going to go to college, and she wanted to be a fashion model or be in the arts. She loved to draw, and she had this little dance of hers that her friends said she did. She had these little cheap $5 slip-on tennis shoes from Kmart she used to wear, and she called them her good luck shoes. And she couldn't find them that night when she changed later on. And but she was just so full of life. And she used to sit in the kitchen with me when I'd prepare dinner, and she'd always say, you know, Mom, I'm going to be 18 pretty soon. I can handle myself. You've got to take more care of Tressa, her younger sister. And you don't have to check on me all the time.
Linda, I want you to stay with us. Yeah. And now I want to introduce Larry Wolgemuth. He is a member of the Iowa Department of Corrections Victim Advisory Council. He was brutally abused as a child, both sexually and physically. He's written about his life in the book Larry Tells Stories, and he and I talked about his experiences in depth on a previous Talk of Iowa. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And we don't have time today to talk much about your personal experiences, but I will say that you were sexually abused repeatedly and brutally over a long period of time by your grandmother's husband. You were also beaten regularly by your father when you were growing up. None of the people who harmed you were ever arrested for what they did, Larry. How did you get involved in the prison system in Iowa?
It's really interesting. There's a psychologist at Newton Correctional Facility named Marty Marsh, who I met quite by accident. I had a refrigerator for sale. He answered the ad. we got to talking. Next thing I know, I've got an invitation to come speak. And I went out there and I told my story to this group of offenders. And it was like a light came on for them. I could see faces that understood because of what I said.
Tell me about what you do. You spoke that one time. What did that lead to for you?
I speak now regularly on victim impact panels. I've spoken at the Crime Victims Rights Week celebration here in Des Moines twice. I do workshops. I've done them for sexual assault counselors, and I do them for the Iowa Board of Certifications for drug and alcohol rehab counselors. It's a story that needs to get out there. We need to talk about this. We need to let people know these things happen, because until they become aware that this is going on in their neighborhoods, they have no reason to do anything about it.
What do you think you get out of the experience of speaking to offenders?
Wow. I have thought about that, and why do I go speak to these offenders? Rekha Basu did an article on me here about 2 months ago, and she quoted my therapist, and he said, I tell Larry, I can't believe you didn't kill someone. I can't believe you're not in prison. So people with my pedigree, that's kind of the natural order of things. We end up in bad places. I fortunately did not. So my impetus, before I even understood what a victim's impact panel was to go speak to these offenders and say, hey, look, I know you're here now, but your life's not over. I was where you are. I was lucky I didn't get caught doing some of the things I did, and I never ended up in prison. But, you know, that life can be good even once you get out of here. And it was real important for me because I thought, if I can make one person understand that they don't have to live this way, maybe there's one future victim that'll never have that experience. There may be one person who doesn't get beaten or raped or robbed from because an offender heard what I said and maybe made the decision to change his life.
Have you had an opportunity to talk to offenders who also were victims themselves? Because so many are.
It's the majority of them. Far and away, I would say 80% of the people that I speak to are victims of some sort. And we're not talking parents who spanked them too hard. We're talking they were beaten and raped and sodomized and pimped out. And they lived these horrible existences. And so when I get to telling my story, it's like we bond, we understand, we came from the same place.
Larry, please stay with us. I'm going to bring Mary Roach into the conversation here in just a moment. But before we do, I want to share the voice of an offender. Ben Kiefer, my colleague who hosts River to River, recently visited the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville in an interview with one prisoner who has spent 35 years in prison. Ben asked him if he wanted to say anything about why he was in prison. He said that when he was 20 years old, he was broken, and in his words, he took liberties with a person that he should not have. He received a life sentence. He calls the circumstances tragic. He says there's probably no way to truly make amends, but he's trying to give back in some way with his volunteering in the prison's hospice program. He says he took advantage of vulnerable people when he was younger and that he's now learned how to give care and respect. Here's a moment from that interview.
Have you had any contact with your victim or the victim's family at all? Has that been part of this at all?
No, I have not had any contact, and that is something I would not reach out and try to do. That's through my years I've learned about so much about victimization and stuff. That's their call. That's not mine. If they want to make contact or they want to find out what's going on or whatever, that's totally in their realm.
Have you thought about how you would react, though?
I would be try to be very understanding to whatever they may feel. Try to make it as meaningful experience for them as they want it to be. Like I say, I am done interfering with people's lives in a negative way. I would just have to try and make it as acceptable to them as possible, because the people that I've harmed in my life, they did not deserve it. And so I would ask that they, every consideration be given them, because they've been through enough for me. I've wrecked enough people's lives. I'm not going to wreck anyone else's.
That's the voice of a man who spent 35 years of a life sentence already in prison. He was talking with Iowa Public Radio's Ben Kiefer, who recently visited the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville. I want to bring Mary Roach into the conversation now. She's the director of the Victim and Restorative Justice Program with the Iowa Department of Corrections. Hello, Mary.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And after the trial and the sentencing and the ordeal that victims' families and victims go through when someone goes to prison, what support is there for those victims from the Department of Corrections after that?
We offer a variety of services for victims, depending on what they need and what they want. Very basic services that we provide are registration and notification so that they can be kept informed of release, of an escape, if an offender should die while in our custody, or if there's some major status change, that we provide them those notifications. But I get a lot of phone calls from victims who just have questions about where is this person, what are they doing, if they're moved from one prison to another, why were they moved? And often from people who are concerned about their release. And my job is to make sure that I can get them connected to local victim services that can help them with safety planning and preparing for an offender's release.
A phrase that a lot of us hear about when we hear reporting on people who are in prison is restitution. Can you explain for me how restitution works?
From the prison side of restitution collection, our department collects 20% of whatever an offender has sent in or earns from work while they're in custody. And so that's just an automatic collection that we do, and we send those monies to the clerk's office, and then they disperse those monies.
And how is it decided how much restitution a prisoner owes?
That's decided in the court at time of sentencing.
Can you give me some insight? Obviously, there are some crimes where there's no amount of money that you could put on what happened to a victim. How is the amount of restitution come to?
Usually courts look specifically at out-of-pocket expenses that a victim may incur. And, of course, it depends on the type of crime. We also have in Iowa a law that should someone lose their life as the result of a felony or violent crime, the offender is automatically assessed a $150,000 judgment to the estate of the person who lost their life.
A lot of that money, I can imagine, it takes a very long time to accumulate. If a prisoner has a job, they are earning usually less than a dollar an hour. A few exceptions, they earn a little more than a dollar an hour. It must take a very long time for this money to accumulate. Does it usually make it to the victim's estate or the victim's families?
Whatever we collect will end up there. And fortunately, in Iowa, we also have the Crime Victim Compensation Program through the Attorney General's office. Because it's often not likely we're going to collect a large amount of money to offset some of those high costs that victims have, such as medical expenses or therapy and counseling, funeral expenses in the cases of homicide. So the Attorney General's Crime Victim Compensation Program can provide services to them up to a limit, and then they are responsible for going and doing their own collection from the offender.
When recently I visited the women's prison in Mitchellville, and when I was there, some of the women were talking about paying off their restitution through community service. They were knitting blankets to give to a shelter or some kind of organization. Are there arrangements like that that are commonly made where victims can or not victims, offenders can work off some of their restitution through serving others?
Well, restitution in the criminal justice system is kind of a broad term, and it can include fines and fees and court costs, sheriff's fees, et cetera, and we put it all under the label restitution. So for those kinds of restitutions that are ordered, an offender can do sometimes, if the court allows it, to do community service projects in lieu of actual money payments. But if it's an individual who is owed money as a crime victim, that cannot be paid off with community service.
We need to take a short break here. We'll be back to our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Mary Roach. She is the director of the Victim and Restorative Justice Program with the Iowa Department of Corrections. Larry Wolgemuth is also here with us. He's a member of the Iowa Department of Corrections Victim Advisory Council. And Linda Sorensen, who is the Victim Service Coordinator with the 6th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections. In just a moment, we'll also be talking with Carl Schilling, who is president of the Iowa Organization for Victim Assistance. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are focusing on the needs of victims in our corrections system. With me right now is Mary Roach. She's the director of the Victim and Restorative Justice Program with the Iowa Department of Corrections. Also with me, Larry Wolgemuth, who is a member of the Iowa Department of Corrections Victim Advisory Council, and Linda Sorensen, who is the Victim Service Coordinator for the 6th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections. And Mary, before the break, we were talking a little bit about how this system works. Let's talk about some of the other programs that you oversee, and one of the parts of what you do is called an apology bank. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. That falls under our Victim Offender Intervention Services program that allows for a variety of different ways for a crime victim to have some type of communication with an offender. And in some cases, an offender, such as we heard earlier, where the victim is not reaching out and is not requesting any kind of communication, but the offender has a desire to express remorse or to offer an apology, we have what we call the apology letter bank. An offender can write an apology letter. It is reviewed. Sometimes I give them feedback, and they may have to rewrite it. But once it's accepted, we, quote, deposit it in the apology letter bank. If we have a registered victim, I'll let them know that a letter exists if they're interested in receiving it. Otherwise, it stays in our bank. And in the future, at some point, if a victim requests that I see, look to see if one exists, then I provide that to them.
Linda also was talking about her opportunity to meet face-to-face with the man who killed her daughter. That's something else that you facilitate.
Yes, that's our Victim Offender Dialogue Program. And I do want to emphasize that is not for everyone. It really is designed as a program to meet the needs of those survivors of violent crime who really wish or have a desire, a need to meet with that person. And we offer some alternatives to people who want to have some kind of communication but do not want to do a face-to-face dialogue.
Victims, of course, are part of this system, Mary, and I can only imagine how overwhelming it is for someone who has never encountered the criminal justice system before to lose a child or be a victim of a crime themselves and all of a sudden be thrust into dealing with all of the complexities of this system. As victims reach out to you, do you feel like you are able to meet their needs?
I don't know. I do the best that I can. And it really depends on what they're coming to us with. And you are so right that being involved with the criminal justice system, it's like entering a whole other world. It's a new language. And I'm very proud of the Iowa Department of Corrections and the efforts that this department has made over the years to become much more victim-sensitive in our communication with victims, much better at explaining our processes, our policies, those kinds of things, so that it's more understandable.
I want to bring Carl Schilling into the conversation now. He is president of the Iowa Organization for Victim Assistance, an organization that has been working hard to make sure that victims get the justice that they're looking for as well. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, it's fun to listen to my heroes, too.
Tell us a little bit about the work that your organization does. We've been talking to Mary about what the Iowa Department of Corrections can offer to victims as far as assistance goes. What does your organization do to augment that and advocate for more support?
We're not a direct service agency. We do advocacy work. We network among the various agencies. For instance, all your guests today are also members of IOBA. And we work together to create strategies to help victims wherever we can. We also have a training program which educates victim witness coordinators and other people who do direct service and keep up with their professional credentials. And we also work with people in the legislature to help them understand the victim viewpoint when it comes to issues of crime and correction and victim rights.
What do you think the greatest need in Iowa as far as victim assistance is right now? What are we still lacking?
You know, the tricky thing about it is that in order for anything to work, you almost have to do everything. The best thing would be to have fewer victims. And one of the ways to do that is that, as Larry has mentioned, whether a person is a victim or an offender depends a great deal upon when the system finds it. Most offenders have indeed been victims, and if we could find them early and turn that around, we'd have fewer victims, fewer people in prison, and I think that's one very good place to start. Anything you can do to prevent these things from happening in the first place would be good.
Well, Carl, stay with us. Linda, I want to go back to you again. Linda Sorensen, you became an advocate for yourself after your daughter was murdered. You went looking for assistance and trying to figure out what you could do to find a support group and ended up helping other victims. Mm-hmm. Clearly, not all people who are victims or in the families of victims can do what you did. What do you want people who are victims of crimes to know about their rights?
I don't think sometimes that people know how much personal power they really do have. You know, when I hear people on panels all the time, they always say, "Did I do okay? Do I get in?" And I said, "You are what makes it. You know, your story is important." And they always say that it makes a difference when they're able to do that and reach out to somebody. And just like Larry was saying, if they can make a difference in one person's life, they all become some kind of an advocate. They sit on victim advisory councils or boards, and they participate in things. I thank them getting the education that they need as far as how to, you know, work within the system, know what's out there, know what we do. People would be blown away if they really knew what corrections did with all the things that we do in there for victims and with some of the people that we work with. But, you know, it's not for everybody. And that's okay. We just have to meet them where they're at.
Larry, telling your story has clearly been a powerful experience for you. When you sit on a victim's panel and you talk to these other people who've been victims of crimes, do you get an idea for how telling one story changes people?
One of the parts about being a victim of crime is the aloneness. There is a sense that nobody has ever been where I am at right now. We're disparate. We're apart. We're not a community. It's not like a tornado ripped through town and we can go hug all our neighbors and friends. We're alone. And for the first time, many of them feel like they have the power and the right to stand up and say, hey, this happened to me and it was a wrong thing to have happen and I need help. And that's a very difficult thing to a point to reach where we ask for help, because society trains us if we can't stand on our own, then there's something wrong with us. Well, there's some things that are far bigger than our ability to deal with them. Crime happens to be one of them, and we need folks that will stand with you when you have these moments. And that's what advocacy does. It says you're not alone anymore.
Carl, you talked about training people to help victims. What do people who help victims need to understand?
Well, that it's a very personal thing, that they're involved in a system that they don't understand and that they need a lot of help with. It's that 30 years ago, a victim was simply a witness. And when you've done your testimony, the system is pretty much done with you. And it was people like Linda who got in there and said, you know, you need support. And to create people to provide that support. And to get people through the system so that they're not really re-victimized, which happens quite a bit, even today, when they're treated a little offhandedly. We found that when victims' rights are considered, everybody profits, even the offenders. And having good, well-trained victim advocates and programs for victims just helps everybody. It's made things better for everyone.
Mary, do you have anything that you'd like to add about that, about helping people who work with victims understand what victims have gone through?
I would say, you know, the most powerful part of any kind of training for anyone working in the criminal justice field is to listen to victims themselves. I think that that's where we learn the most, are people like Larry and Linda who share their personal journey, not just the crime but the aftermath of the crime, so that we have just a better understanding of what people go through in recovery. And the other thing that I would mention is that for a lot of crime victims, what's critical is that they be provided with information, that they're given avenues to participate in the process at whatever level they wish. But information is power. And the more that we can educate that person and give them the information that they need so they can make decisions on their own, that's critical.
Earlier, Linda was talking about when she came face to face with the man who killed her daughter, that the mask of the monster came off and she saw that he is a man. And when you meet with offenders, for the most part, you realize, you know, these are human beings who made terrible, terrible mistakes. But my experience recently sitting down next to a woman who committed a crime that I would consider to be unforgivable and reading about it, seeing about it in the media, you can't imagine how someone could do that thing. But she is a woman. She is a human being. I'm sure that's a painful process for a lot of victims to go through, to understand that the offenders are also human beings. Is that important, Mary?
That's actually one of the risks that I talk about with victims as we're preparing for a potential dialogue, is that things may change for them in ways that they may not be anticipating or that they necessarily want. That's why our preparation process is very important, that we spend time helping people get ready to the best of our ability. But that is often the case, and ultimately our goal is that the victim and the offender leave that meeting feeling that they have reached a different level of of healing or more at peace with themselves.
Linda, do you have anything to add on that, since that's an experience that you went through? Is that important for victims, for many victims, to come to that realization about the people who perpetrated those crimes?
Yes, everything that Mary said is right on. Like I said earlier, that even though you go through preparations, the risk is that you never really are. I mean, you go in and hopefully you're going to take out what you're supposed to. And most of the time, I think that does happen.
With the changes that you've been involved in our criminal justice system in Iowa, do you feel now that victims have the services that they need in this state, Linda?
It has gotten so much better over the years. And I think even victim services, when it used to be just the direct services for victims, which is true, but they're also realizing that it goes much further, that it also are a lot of people that are in the system that have been victims as well.
Mary, I'm going to let you have the last word today. What are your challenges that you're still trying to work on? What are your hopes for the future in victim support in the Department of Corrections?
I would hope that the programs that we currently have continue to expand and broaden. Right now I'm an office of one, so for the future it would be wonderful to be an office of five. That's just a number I'm pulling out of the air, basically just saying there's so much work to do, having more people doing this kind of work is my hope for the future. And I guess more than anything is just that I feel so grateful to have this kind of position, that I have those opportunities to meet some very inspiring survivors of crime who show tremendous strength in the face of adversity that is an inspiration for me personally. So I hope to continue this work for a long time.
Mary Roach, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mary Roach is the director of the Victim and Restorative Justice Program with the Iowa Department of Corrections. Carl Schilling, thank you very much, president of the Iowa Organization for Victim Assistance. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you.
Larry Wolgemuth, thank you so much for sharing your story on Talk of Iowa and for the work that you do. Larry Wolgemuth is a survivor of sexual and physical abuse. He's also a member of the Iowa Department of Corrections Victim Advisory Council. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Charity.
And Linda Sorensen lost her daughter when her daughter was 17 years old in 1989. Her daughter, Leah, was murdered. Linda is now the Victim Service Coordinator for the 6th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections. Linda, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much.
And for being so generous with your story.
Thank you for giving my daughter a voice.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from John Pemble. And we'll continue the series on corrections in Iowa today at noon on River to River. Ben Kiefer, host of that program, is here with me today. What aspect of corrections will we be looking at noon?
Well, Charity, following on the heels of this very compelling hour you've had here, we're going to ask the question, when should a life sentence be reconsidered? Talk about one of the cases, the case in 1974 of Raspberry Williams, who shot and killed a Waterloo man over a gambling debt. This year, Governor Branstad granted Williams' request for a commutation. Talk to a host of people to get at that question, when and if a life sentence should be reconsidered. So tune in at noon to hear that conversation.
All right. Thank you very much, Ben. Again, River to River today at noon, and the series continues for the next 4 weeks here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.